So I'm Sydney, and Gianni, as Alex said, and yeah, today we're going to be telling you about our efficient quantum algorithm for port-based teleportation. So the way that this is going to work is I'm first going to introduce to you port-based teleportation, what it is, why we care about it, and then I'm going to talk about some of the symmetries that it has when you perform it with a pretty good measurement, and how that some connections that has allowed us to find between port-based teleportation and other representation theoretic tasks, namely the Schur transform and something we're calling generalized induced drops. And then Gianni is going to come up and tell you a little bit about block diagonalizing homomorphic images of reps, which includes generalized induced reps, the resulting efficient algorithm for port-based teleportation, and further applications of this work. So all of this work is based on a paper that we put out in October about the efficient algorithm for port-based teleportation, as well as an additional upcoming paper that's going to contain more about the connections to these more general representation theoretic tasks, which should be coming out shortly, except for we keep adding things to it. So yeah, soon. Okay, so what is port-based teleportation? Port-based teleportation is a variant of quantum teleportation where, rather than sharing a single Bell pair, Alice and Bob are going to share n-1 pairs of quantum systems in a joint entangled state, and we call each of these pairs a port. Alice will have an additional quantum system that we're going to label n that she wishes to teleport to Bob, and in order to do this, she's going to first perform a joint POVM on the system in her ports, which will give her outcome I. She'll then send I to Bob. Bob will throw away all of his ports except for I, which will then hold the approximately teleported state, depending on the POVM that they choose to use and the choice of the joint entangled state. But for certain choices of the resource state and the POVM, the fidelity of the approximate teleportation will go to 1 as n goes to infinity. Why is port-based teleportation interesting? Why would we bother to use all of this entanglement to perform it? The reason is that port-based teleportation achieves something called unitary equivariance, which means that Bob can perform a unitary operation U on the teleported state before or after he learns which port it ends up on. And this is basically because, unlike in traditional teleportation, the state is not teleported with any Pauli correction on it. It's not encrypted in any way. So after he receives the state and he's thrown away all of the other ports, he can perform the unitary on it. Or before he knows which port it ends up on, he can just perform U on all of the ports, and he'll know that it has happened to the teleported state. So essentially, the way you should think about port-based teleportation is that all of this entanglement that we're using is a price that we're paying in order to achieve this unencrypted teleportation. Okay. The unitary equivariance of port-based teleportation makes it very useful for something called non-local quantum computation. Non-local quantum computation is a model of quantum computation where Alice and Bob, who can be even space-like separated, can perform a joint unitary on their quantum systems using just local unitaries and a single round of quantum of communication. So this is something that Alex has been using to study ADS-CFT, starting in these papers, because in ADS-CFT, local quantum computations in the bulk can correspond to non-local quantum computations on the boundary. So in this paper from 2022, he used this to bound the entanglement consumed in a non-local quantum computation above and below by the complexity of the unitary accomplished. So this is really interesting because it tells us something about this relationship in ADS-CFT between the entanglement on the boundary and the complexity of the unitary in the bulk. However, even though he bounded the entanglement above and below, these bounds have a triply exponential gap, in part because of the inefficiency of port-based teleportation. It's really a bottleneck subroutine for non-local quantum computation. And so by finding an efficient algorithm for port-based teleportation, we can actually improve the gap in these bounds from triply to doubly exponential. So that's one application of it. Okay. The specific port-based teleportation protocol that we look at is one where the entangled resource state are n minus one pairs of maximally entangled qubits, and the POVM is this pretty good measurement for distinguishing these states rho I. So the states rho I are the maximally entangled state between Alice's ith and nth port, and maximally mixed on everything else. You sum them up to get this port-based teleportation operator rho, and then the measurement operators for the POVM are these pi I, which are the states rho I weighted by the port-based teleportation operator rho. We also have this correction delta, which is just necessary to make this a valid POVM. And Felix Luditsky showed in 2020 that this pretty good measurement is the optimal measurement for port-based teleportation with this choice of resource state. And also, you can also optimize the resource state, but the pretty good measurement will still be the optimal measurement. Okay, so our strategy to implement port-based teleportation with this measurement is to take advantage of the symmetries of the measurement. So in particular, I'm just going to put the measurement back up here. If you look at this maximally entangled state, you can rewrite it in tensor network notation this way. And that makes it clear that if we act by a unitary on the port I and the conjugate of the unitary on the port N, in tensor network notation that looks like this. So we get U over here, U star there. We can move U star around so that it becomes U dagger. Then these guys annihilate, and we see that the maximally entangled state has this symmetry. The maximally entangled state is in both rho I and rho. And so what this means is that rho and rho I both have this partially conjugated unitary symmetry, where we always have U on any port I and U star on the last port, the system that will be teleported. Okay.
Sorry, I'm a little bit lost. Can you really explain this? Pretty good measurement and maybe a bit slower. I'm not sure I follow it.
Yeah.
What exactly is the measurement doing?
So, sorry, these slides are kind of not going. Yeah. So the pretty good measurement is a measurement that was come up with for this state discrimination problem. So this measurement is the measurement to distinguish between these states rho I. And basically what you see is that if you write down the channel for port-based teleportation and compute the fidelity of the teleportation, maximizing that fidelity looks exactly the same as trying to distinguish between these states rho I.
Wait, so Alice has some qubit she's trying to set?
Yes.
And how is this measurement involving this qubit and these bell pairs?
Yeah, okay, so Alice has these n minus one bell pairs and this additional quantum system, and she's going to perform this measurement on everything that she holds.
Okay.
And yeah, this measurement has it has n minus one outcomes. And so then the outcome of this measurement will say which of Bob's n minus one ports the approximately teleported state is going to end up on.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you. No, thank you for the question. Yeah.
Can I add a comment?
Yeah.
So it's like rho I. If your measurement outcome was rho I, it'd be like you projected the maximally entangled state into the qubit you're trying to teleport and the port you're trying to get it onto.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would like work perfectly if you got one of those outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't form a complete measurement, and then there's basically some other junk going on, this sandwiching with rho minus 1/2 that turns it into a balance of POVMs. You can think of it as like you're basically trying to project it onto one of the points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Alex. Okay. I can't decide if I should play this again because they're kind of not working. Okay. So yeah, maybe I should back up. Right. So we're trying to implement this pretty good measurement. What I'm trying to argue here is that both rho and rho I, which you know are important constituents that make up these measurement operators, have this partially conjugated unitary symmetry. So that's something that we're going to take advantage of to implement the measurement. They also have an additional symmetry. So again, if you rewrite these maximally entangled states in tensor network notation, you see that you can also represent this as first a permutation between I and N, which I've drawn here in blue, followed by a partial transposition on the nth system. It's not working though when I click it. Well, maybe it works now. Okay. So we have this partial, we have this permutation between the ith and the nth system, followed by this transpose on the nth system. So that's what I've written out here. In is the permutation. V here just means the natural representation of the permutation. In other words, we're just directly permuting the qubits. And Tn is the partial transpose on the nth system. And so what this means is that both rho and rho I are elements of this thing that I'm going to call the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators, which I'm just going to define as being the span of any permutation from Sn. We take the natural representation of it, and then we perform the partial transpose on the last system. And actually, perhaps a bit surprisingly, the statement that rho and rho I are elements of this algebra is exactly equivalent to the statement that they have the partially conjugated unitary symmetry that I argued on the previous slide. And that fact is a consequence of something called generalized Schur-Weil duality, that these two symmetries are equivalent to each other. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about Schur-Weil duality and how it works. Okay. So first, maybe just to review, I'm going to talk about what standard Schur-Weil duality is. So standard Schur-Weil duality concerns usually the algebra of permutation operators, C over VSN. So the algebra of these permutation operators just acting on the Hilbert space of n qubits, like this. So the single permutation just permutes the qubits. It also concerns this algebra over CUD on n qubits, which just acts on the n qubits by performing u on each one. And these two algebras, it's clear to see that these two actions commute with each other because permuting the qubits does not affect acting with u on each of them. And in fact, these two algebras are each other's commutants in this Hilbert space, which means that any operation that you find that commutes with everything in the algebra of permutation operators must be in the other algebra, and vice versa. And as a consequence of this commutant relationship, you get a very interesting decomposition of the Hilbert space. It decomposes simultaneously into EREPs of Sn and Ud. Here I have the Hilbert space. Over here, I have a direct sum over EREPs. The EREPs are labeled by these letters lambda. Lambda are Young diagrams or partitions of N. If you don't know what a Young diagram is, it doesn't really matter. The point is it just labels an EREP. You might be used to seeing an EREP decomposition where we have like an EREP here and a multiplicity space there. What this is saying is, these P lambda are EREPs of Sn. These Q lambda would be their multiplicity spaces, but these Q lambda are EREPs instead of UD. So if we are viewing this as a decomposition into EREPs of Sn, what it's saying is their multiplicity spaces are actually these EREPs of UD, and vice versa. We can also view this as a decomposition into EREPs of UD, and then the multiplicity spaces are given by these EREPs of Sn. So what this means is that if you can transform into the basis that implements or respects this decomposition, then you can simultaneously decompose any element of Sn or Ud into EREPs. And that's a pretty useful thing. There's a transform that accomplishes this decomposition, so it transforms from the computational basis into one that simultaneously decomposes both elements of Sn and Ud into EREPs, and that transform is called the Schur transform. Okay, so that's standard Schur-Weil duality. Does anybody have any questions about it before we move on? Okay. So what we're going to actually be talking about today is a kind of generalization of Schirweil duality that we call twisted Schirweil duality. But in exactly analogously to the standard kind of Schirweil duality, we're going to have the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators that I introduced earlier. And its commutant is instead going to be UD tensor n minus 1 tensor UD star. So these operators commute with each other. The way that you can think about this is that the partial transpose in the algebra of permutation operators creates a maximally entangled state, and that that corresponds to this partial conjugation. Because these two algebras are each other's commutants, the Hilbert space in exactly the same way enjoys a simultaneous decomposition into ERUPS of the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators and UD. This is what that decomposition looks like. So here, the ERUPS are actually labeled by this alpha, which is a Young diagram that partitions n minus 2. So these correspond, these are the same things that label ERUPS of Sn minus 2, for example. And then here we have ERUPS of the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators. And here we have ERUPS of UD. This additional space is just something that I'm going to kind of gloss over and not really talk about, because any operator in the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators that non-trivially permutes and transposes on the last subsystem will only be represented non-trivially in this first part. Okay, so these are the yes.
UD star.
Sorry.
What is UD star?
Yeah, it's just the complex conjugate.
What's the difference between UD star and UD? At the group.
Oh, I just mean that. So it's the same group, but I'm describing here the action on the Hilbert space. So I'm going to act like when I take. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll be acting on U on the by some U on the first n minus one systems, and then yeah, U star on the last one. Okay. All right. So yeah, what are these ERUPS of the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators? I realize I'm not justifying going this far down the rabbit hole, but it will eventually help us out. Okay. So as I said before, elements of the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators that permute and transpose the last qubit, that permutation followed by the transpose creates this maximally entangled state. So these elements are only going to be represented non-trivially on these states here, where this first guy, I, are just computational basis states on everything except for wherever you get the maximally entangled state. So we know these elements are only going to be represented non-trivially in this space. I can rewrite this using this permutation so that I always get the maximally entangled state between the n minus 1 and nth qubit. And so this is the exact same space. I've just rewritten it a little bit. And then it's actually possible to recognize the ERUPS of the algebra by just, if we remember from before, they're going to be labeled by these alpha that decompose n minus 2. And so it turns out all you have to do is actually decompose these computational basis states, which are on n minus 2 qubits, into ERUPS of Sn minus 2.
So what is Kn? What is this state?
Yeah, OK. So so these guys are the quantum systems. K and n are indices of them. And whenever you have an element of this algebra that permutes between K and N, after you perform the partial transpose on N.
You did it the last qubit?
Yes.
K is the others?
Yes, it's some other qubit.
See, so that's an ideal.
Exactly.
I is?
I is just some, anything else on all of the rest of the qubits. Yes. Yeah, we know that we have to get the maximally entangled state somewhere, and so this is just maximally entangled state between N and wherever else. Right. OK. So to find the ERUPS, you can actually just transform this computational basis state into some ERUP of Sn minus 2. And that turns out to be enough because of this like very close relationship between the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators and just the algebra of permutation operators. So these scary looking states here, this alpha is just some EREP label for some EREP FSN minus 2, and these K alpha are just states that span that EREP. Okay, so these are the EREPs of the algebra. They have kind of an interesting structure, where, as I said before, we have this EREP basis of SN minus 2, and then we have these permutations that always come from SN minus 1 mod SN minus 2. This is kind of an interesting structure. When we were looking at this, we realized that these objects are really closely related to induced representations, which are kind of a bread and butter object in representation theory, but they're a little bit more general than that. And so, yeah, I'm going to talk about this more general kind of representation. This is a novel kind of representation that we recognize here. We're calling it a generalized induced rep. This is going to be, a little bit of formalism, but I'm going to connect it back in the end. Okay, I'll just introduce. Yes?
What was up to add that in the previous slide?
Sorry. Come on. So alpha is some Young diagram that partitions n minus 2. It's some label of an EREP of SN minus 2.
Is it just the same Young diagram? We would use the same one?
Yes. So for, yeah. Yeah, so for every EREP of SN minus 2, you can construct a corresponding H alpha. R is a multiplicity label. If you were to actually decompose the Hilbert space into EREPs of SN minus 2, you could get some number of copies of the EREP alpha. But for H alpha, which copy doesn't really matter. So I'm just choosing some sure basis states for some arbitrary fixed R.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. Thank you for the question. Okay. So yeah, I'm going to talk about generalized induced reps right now without really motivating them. So in order to construct these things, we're going to start with a representation of the group. So rho here is going to be the map that implements the representation, and u is going to be the space that it ends up on. And we're going to call this the parent representation. We're also going to have a subgroup that lives in G, and the restriction of the representation rho to the subgroup. And in general, when we restrict rho to H, u can decompose into different sub-representations under that action. So we're going to pick some sub-representation V of U under the action of H. And that representation we're going to call the base representation. Okay, that's a lot all at once. So I think the thing to keep in mind is that when we use rho and act on V by some element of H, it's going to map V to V, because V is a representation of H under the action of H. But we can also use rho to act by any element of G on V. And in general, that will map into something in U, because we don't know that V is necessarily a representation of G. Does that make sense? OK. So then we can use this action of rho on V by any element of G to define a different interesting kind of representation. And that's going to be the generalized induced representation. So this representation is just going to be the collection of acting on everything in V by anything in G and seeing what you get at the end. So rho is the representation that we start with of G. And so we're considering it as a representation of G and also the restriction to H. Yeah. So the big idea here is that this is a little bit backwards from how I've presented it, but we're trying to lift this base representation into some new interesting representation of G. So we want to figure out how G acts on all of V, on all of the base representation. But if all we had was the base representation, we wouldn't know how G acts on it. So instead, we start with this parent representation that's going to tell us how G acts on all of V. OK, This is a little bit abstract, but yeah, so we have this parent representation, we have the base representation, and we're constructing this new representation by acting with G on all of V. Now, for some generic element in G, we can decompose it always into some element of H and a transversal from G mod H. And then when we act on V, it's the same as first acting by this element of H and then acting by the transversal tau. Well, since rho H maps V to V, this will just give some element of V, which we're going to call V prime. So this is the same as just doing rho tau on V prime. And what this means is that when we act by rho, by every element in G, what really matters is the transversal part. So we can rewrite this generalized induced rep as a sum of subspaces, where we just act by all of the transversals on all of V. Okay. So when we do this, in general, these subspaces are going to be linearly dependent. And so this is the sum is kind of messy. But it is possible for this sum to be a direct sum. And in that case, what you get is a true induced rep. So that's the sense in which these are generalizations of induced reps. Induced reps are just a special case of these. For a fixed representation V and subgroup H of G, there is one single true induced rep, but there are a lot of different generalized induced reps that you can construct depending on exactly how the action of rho works. Yes.
I think I'm a bit confused. So, in the top line,
yes,
this V weird symbol G, this is some span, it's some space, and at the bottom line, it's just you've summed over everything, and it's just kind of one element.
This is a sum of subspaces.
I see. So then, okay, so this sum represents a subspace. No.
Yes. Not one element. Yeah, I'm just putting all of these subspaces together.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, the notation is a little confusing.
Okay. Yeah.
We wrote it like this because it makes direct sort of a direct analogy to the case where this becomes like a big O plus direct sum.
Okay.
And that's when you have a true induced rep.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, this is a lot of formalism and it's pretty abstract, so I'm going to do a couple quick examples. Okay, so the first example, I'm going to consider a group G and its regular representation. So the space U is just the group algebra over G. And then for the subgroup H and G, I'm going to choose the base rep to be some irrep of H, which will always, you can always find any irrep of H inside the group algebra CH. Okay. So now, to construct the induced rep, we need to figure out how G acts on V. Notice that for any element, little v in V, because it's in this group algebra, we can always rewrite it as a sum of elements in H with some coefficients. And so when we act by the transversal rho tau on V, what we get is just the transversal comes in and multiplies all of these elements of H. And we end up with something that is in the group algebra over tau H. So what this means is that if we have two different transversals, tau not equals tau prime, rho tau ends up in C tau H, and rho tau prime maps you to C tau prime H, which are in general disjoint things in the entire group algebra. So if this whole thing is CG, we start in CH, and tau maps us into C tau H, and tau prime maps us into C tau prime H. So when we sum up all of these subspaces for all of these different transversals, rho tau V, each of these is going to end up in a disjoint part of CG, and we're going to get a direct sum. So this is actually the canonical way that you construct the true induced representation. So whenever I say true induced representation, this is kind of what you can think of. The action is just the one that we automatically know that we have from the regular representation. Okay. Now I'm going to give an example of something that's actually generalized. Consider the Hilbert space of 3 qubits. This should be C2 tensor 3. And then G will be the symmetric group that acts by permuting the three qubits. And then the subgroup I'm going to consider will be S2, which permutes the first two qubits. And then the representation that I want to induce from will be the sine representation on those first two qubits. So I'm going to choose it to look like this. It'll just be what's given by the single vector V, which is 0, 1 on the first two qubits followed by 1, 0. Now this is embedded in the entire Hilbert space of three qubits, so we need something on all three qubits. So I just choose 0 for the last qubit. So this is the representation that I'm going to induce from. To get the full induced representation, I need to act by all of the transversals in V, right? So I've written that out here concretely. The transversals of S2 and S3 are just the identity, the permutation 2,3 and the permutation 1,3. I can act by these very directly on this vector. This is what I get. If you notice, these things are actually linearly dependent because rho 1,3 is equal to rho E minus rho 2,3. And so when I sum up all of the subspaces, I get something that is actually 2D instead of naively 3D. So this is actually a generalized induced rep because when we perform the induction, we end up with some linear dependence. We don't get a direct sum of these subspaces. And just some intuition that might not actually be useful is that basically this is all because we started out with only 0 on the third qubit, and so the action of the transversals on this qubit can't really be captured. Okay, so we've seen a true induced rep, we've seen a generalized one. How does this connect back to what we were talking about before? So the EREPs of the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators are actually generalized induced reps. For them, the parent rep is just the Hilbert space of n qubits that we started out with in the beginning. The group is G is Sn minus 1, which permutes the first n minus 1 qubits. The base rep is Sn minus 2, which permutes the first n minus 2. And the representation that we're inducing from is this V alpha, where P alpha is some EREP of Sn minus 2, again labeled by alpha divides Sn minus 2, or divides n minus 2. And then we've also tacked on here the maximally entangled state. Basically, we kind of have to do this in the sense that this is something that's embedded in this full Hilbert space, so it needs to be big enough to fit in there, right? Okay. So these V alpha are the EREP of Sn minus 2, which is labeled by alpha and spanned by these K alpha. And then we also have this maximally entangled state. When we perform the induction, we act. We act by the transversals in Sn minus 1. P alpha is the EREP of Sn minus 2 labeled by alpha. Yes. When we perform the induction, we act by these transversals on V alpha. And what we get exactly matches the expression for H alpha we had before. So you might say this is all fine and good. Why did we do all of this? It's nice that they have this structure. This is actually going to be pretty fruitful. So, okay, let's recap everything we've done so far. We're trying to find an efficient algorithm for port-based teleportation with a pretty good measurement. What we've observed is that the port-based teleportation operator rho and the states rho I are elements of this algebra of partially transposed permutation operators. And the EREPs of this algebra, the EREPs where rho and rho I are represented non-trivially, are these generalized induced reps H alpha, which are induced from Sn minus 2 to Sn minus 1. How can we use this? Yes.
J is for the first n minus 1 qubit, right? Then H is for first n minus 2 qubits. And then why can we construct something which is like, I can say, symmetric over n minus 1 qubits? In this construct, in this situation, the only final qubit is the special one, right?
Yes, the final qubit is the special one.
And looking at the construction J and H, you're treating like the n minus one qubit kind of special, right?
Yes, it becomes kind of special because, yes, so the nth qubit is the only one that we're trying to teleport, but we need this maximally entangled state between it and something else,
yes.
Right? And so that sort of picks out some other qubit that's also part of the maximally entangled state. And by using the permutation, we permute that, we choose to always permute that into the n minus 1th qubit. And so that kind of selects out the n minus 1th qubit specially. Yeah. Okay, so how are we going to use this? So because these, sorry. I think what's happening is it's changing up there and not on my screen, and it's confusing me. Okay, so because each H alpha is, they're not just ereps of this algebra, they're also representations of Sn minus 1. We saw that before because they're these generalized induced reps from Sn minus 2 to Sn minus 1. And so because they're representations of Sn minus 1, they can be decomposed into ereps of Sn minus 1. This is what that decomposition looks like. So we get a direct sum over ereps of Sn minus 1. They look like the label alpha. You just add a box to the Young diagram in all legal ways. And you get these ereps p mu, which are ereps of Sn minus 1. The key thing to notice about this decomposition is that there are no multiplicity spaces here. This is a multiplicity-free decomposition. So in general, if you take something from Sn with some kind of Sn minus 1 symmetry that is represented in here, it would be block diagonalized in the multiplicity spaces. But because these multiplicity spaces are trivial, anything with an Sn minus 1 symmetry will be diagonalized. And for us, this is particularly important because our port-based teleportation operator rho has an Sn minus 1 symmetry. Because it's the sum of all of these rho I states that sort of rotate between the different n minus 1 ports. So in summary, what this means is that if we can transform to an ERUP basis of this algebra, i.e. decompose into these H alpha, and then further decompose each generalized induced ERUP H alpha into these ERUPs of Sn minus 1, we're going to have, we're going to be in a pretty good place for implementing the pretty good measurement because we will have diagonalized rho and also, as it turns out, simplified the states rho I quite a bit. So we package this transformation together. We call it performing a subgroup reduced twisted Schur transform. It's a twisted Schur transform in the sense that it decomposes into these ERUPs of Sn minus, or of this algebra. Like in the Schur-Weil duality, and it's subgroup reduced in that it further decomposes into ERUPs of Sn minus 1. Okay, so putting it all together, what we found is that performing this twisted Schur transform is going to diagonalize rho and really simplify the states rho I, and that's going to make it possible for us to perform port-based teleportation in polynomial time in NND. That's really the key to our whole algorithm, is performing this ERUP decomposing transform. At the same time that we were working on this, there was some other work by some other people. In particular, last year, Quinn Nguyen also came up with an efficient Schur transform to perform this decomposition. He called it the mixed Schur transform. We call it the twisted Schur transform. At the same time, Dmitry Grinko, Adam Burchart, and Maris Ozels also came up with an efficient twisted Schur transform, as well as an efficient circuit for port-based teleportation. In both of their works, they work from the other side of the Schur-Weil duality. So we work from the side that concerns the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators. They work from the side that has the partially conjugated unitary action. And so their Schur transforms are implemented a little bit differently from ours. They basically use some kind of cascading Clebsch-Gordan transforms. I'd like to advertise these papers because I think their transform is actually a bit cleaner than ours and a bit nicer. I think there's some efficiency advantages. But I think the key contribution of our work is that by performing the transform from the other side of the duality, from the side with the algebra of partially transposed permutation operators, it's from this side that we're able to see that this transform is a special case of this general problem of block diagonalizing generalized induced representations. So it's from working from the side of this duality that we're able to see this connection to this more general set of problems. And as Gianni is going to discuss a little bit later, we think this is interesting because these generalized induced representations also crop up in other places, particularly in other kinds of generalized Sure-Weil dualities. You will also find them. So by kind of solving it in general, we can have a more widely applicable tool. So what Gianni is going to talk to you about is how we came up with a general algorithm for block diagonalizing these representations. It's not actually efficient in general, but it is efficient for some specific cases, and that's where we get port-based teleportation. Okay, one sec while we switch the microphone.
Okay, so now that Bernie can tell you something about how we are applying this general algorithm for block diagonalizing generalized induced representations into ERMs. And our strategy will be first to use the fact that a generalized induced representation is in fact a homomorphic image of a truly induced representation. And remember that representation of the group consists of vector space, which carries with it a linear representation group here, which associates each group element with a linear mapping, which is invertible. And a multiple homomorphism is defined to be a linear map that maps from one module to another such that it commutes with group action, which means if we are first acting a group element G on a vector V in V, and then we apply the map, this is equivalent as if we are first applying the map I, and which will get us W, and then we act G on it. This can be described in a pictorial way, where here we are having the kernel of phi to be a set of elements in V that are mapped to zero. And according to the first isomorphism theorem of modules, we will find that the quotient of V over the kernel is actually isomorphic as a module to the image of phi. And homomorphisms are really fundamental in mathematics because almost all mathematical objects have a homomorphism, which is a structure preserving that. And for the modules, they are just preserving the reflections. And the important example here is that every generalized induced rep is, in fact, a homomorphic image of a true induced rep, which is the unique rep that is induced from the module V. And this map can be constructed naturally and be proven easily. And the takeaway point is just that every generalized induced rep is a homomorphic image of a true induced rep. To achieve our task of block diagonalizing generalized induced rep, we hence created a general procedure of reducing any homomorphic image of representations into ERMs. Suppose that we are given a map phi, which maps from V to W, which is a homomorphism. And suppose that we already, so it is defined by mapping all the basis elements VI into a set of elements WI and W, which is genetically linear dependent. This is because the image of a homomorphism has a lower dimension than the Krieg image. And once we have, we'll have to transform the basis elements VI of V into VI prime, such that it decomposes the host representation V into the ERAPs P mu I here. And simultaneously, this basis transformation will block diagonalize the group actions in these spaces, which is denoted as phi here, into a direct sum of matrix ERAPs phi sine. And the idea is that the homomorphism of each ERAP P mu I in V would actually either be isomorphic to an ERAP that is labeled by mu, or it is zero. This is because the kernel of phi is restricted to this P mu I, is actually a sub-representation of P mu I. And because P mu I is an absolute, it could either be zero or P mu I itself. And this means the quotient of the group of the opposite three, either 0 or PV. And this means that since our VI prime, the transform racing, the partitions V into the EREPs, is a generating set. And following this homomorphism, we'll get the WI prime, which will also be a generating set for W. And they will be partitioning it into the phi, p, mu, I, which are EREPs. So we call it an EREP decomposing span vector of W. And however, notice that because W has a lower dimension than V in general, so this means that in our image, the identical copies may be linearly dependent. So the resolution to this is linear algebraic, that we can use some Gaussian elimination to the linear dependent copies of the EREPs and apply it to the vectors in it, such that we'll have some real echelon form. And such that we'll have something that is minimally independent. And on the right hand side, I'm drawing here a picture that is a version of before. So on the left hand side, we have two ovals, and I use different colors to represent different non isomorphic VRs in V, which is partitioned by the transform basis VI prime. And notice that this is the kernel, so this blue EREP lies in the kernel. So this means that phi p mu I for this blue mu will be zero. And here notice that for the red EREP, we have two identical copies in V, but they are partially in the kernel, which means that they will be non-zero but linearly dependent. So by applying some linear transformation to the multiplicity spaces of EREPs, we will be doing a linear recombination of these two copies and make them one of them entirely contained in the kernel and the other out of the kernel. And so by mapping through phi, this EREP in the kernel will be shrunk to zero, and the other one will be remained in W. And so all of this means that by applying x1 by x2, we can decompose W into a direct sum of EREPs, which is a subset of all of the EREPs in V. So up to now, we have only considering linearly independency and linear dependency. So how we may want to ask the question, like, how can we obtain an orthonormal basis that can decompose the homomorphic representation into EREPs? This may be useful in quantum platforms because when we are doing some quantum computing, we have a computational basis. There is some routine orthogonality of those bases. They are distinguishable from each other. And we and this is actually always achievable if we are measuring orthogonality using a gene invariant in the product, which means this is meaning that if we have two vectors W I and WJ in W and a group element G in G, then G acting on WI and G acting on WJ WJ when we are in a product. Then this will be equal to WI in a product with WJ. And if you're in doubt with such an inner product of W and measuring by the orthogonality, then we can further bulk-wise into the unitary matrix EREPs. Remember that phi prime is the bulk-wise matrix forms of group fractions. And here, by meaning that unitary matrix EREPs, we are just meaning that sign mu for each group element G is the unitary matrix. And so now we are considering orthogonality, so we will be applying some grand procedure to orthonormalize our space. And if we check the grand matrix, we will find that after we've applied the X, this grand matrix Q prime, which is defined, whose each element is defined as the inner product of a pair of vectors in the spanning sets that we are focusing on. And this Q prime will actually commute with the phi prime, which is a bot phi ice cream action, using the following thing. And after that, because Q prime will commute with phi prime g, and phi prime g has this form, and according to Schur's lemma, this means this Q prime will be block diagonal as well, and it will actually be block diagonal in the multiplicity spaces of the units. More essentially, we can see that all of our conditions are used, and by using the gene invariant in the product in W, we are actually making the localized isotypic components orthogonal, whereby isotypic components, I mean the space of Birkhoff's that are identical. So for non-identical Birkhoff spaces, they will be mutually orthogonal. And by using that sign U is the unitary matrix, and under and gene invariant in the product, this ensures that basis elements within a single Birkhoff pair are orthogonal. And so all the remaining degrees of freedom of non-orthogonality and linear dependency are reduced to the multiplicity spaces of Birkhoffs and captured by this K prime here. And this means that in the second step, we will just do some linear operations in the multiplicity spaces to make it Q prime into double prime Q, which is the identity matrix, which means that our resulting basis elements will be orthogonal. And a recap is that if we are using a gene invariant in a product, we can first find a change of basis matrix from the pre-image, and use that to block diagonalize the matrix form of group actions into a direct sum of unitary matrix Birkhoffs. And then we will use this same basis transformation and apply it to the spanning vectors wi in w and transform it into wi prime. And after that, we will track the non-orthogonality linear dependency using the gram matrices. And it is ensured that it is block diagonal in the multiplicity spaces. So when we are diagonalizing Q prime, we will actually obtain an orthogonal basis. So in the second step, we just focus on the image. So this means that we are now having an algorithm for block diagonalizing generalizing these representation as their homomorphic images of treating these representations. The first step is we will focus on the pre-image, which are treatment stress. So we have derived the basis transformation matrix that can block diagonalize any treatment stress from an Irref, the alpha of H into Irrefs. And this will be the base case. And for the inductions from other linear representation, this is just by patching together those transformation matrices. This S would be equivalent to an inverse Fourier transform of the subgroup H, followed by a quantum Fourier transform of the group G. Importantly, is that this quantum Fourier transform of G should be suddenly reduced down the tower of G to H, which means that after applying this quantum Fourier transform, the obtained Birkhoffs should be blocked at once when we are restricting to the subgroup H. So this is the meaning of subgroup reduced or subgroup adapted. And the idea is that we will be using the Frobenius capacity in terms of the spaces of modular homomorphism. We actually have constructed an explicit map, and we will map from an orthogonal basis of the spaces of restrictions to obtain a basis of the homomorphism of the set of the space of homomorphisms from the spaces of inductions. For each homomorphism, it is actually preserving the group action, which means that it will produce a group action, and is equivalent to a part of the unitary matrix X here. Our second step is just multiplicity separation, and this is, in general, inefficient, But for generalized end-use representations in particular, there are interesting representation structures where this can be exponentially improved, the efficiency. For example, when the original WI vectors in the pre-image, they are orthonormal, then the orthonormality is automatically satisfied, so we do not need to do any multiplicity separation, which is essentially the orthogonalization of the multiplicity spaces. And if we have degenerate eigenvalues in each block Q mu, which means that it will be proportional to identity, we can use some character ferrite methods to calculate that. And if this is the case, then this means that this X2 would actually be an amplitude amplification, which is just the scaling of the eigenvectors. And if we have an orthogonal constitutional structure, which means that we can split the tower from G to H to a list of towers, and then we can reduce the whole problem of reducing generalized induced graphs into each level. And then each level can further decompose it into orthogonal subproblems. And in that case, the multiplicity separation can be split up as well. And that will exponentially improve the efficiency of multiplicity separation. Our first running example will be the standard Schwarz duality. So we can first decompose the tensor space into a direct sum of Young modules, where each of them is spanned by standard basis elements of the same type, which have the same number of I's standard basis elements. And this is actually a generalized induced graph because this can be obtained, such a Young module can be obtained by applying all possible permutations to a fixed vector V in a Young module, and which is the trivial wrap of Sn1 times lambda times Snv. Because when we are acting this group on this vector, it will just map it back into this vector. This is actually a tree induced graph because all of those basis vectors in the Young module, they are orthonormal in the computational in the product. And so the second step, X2, can be omitted. And in the first step, we have the quantum Fourier transform separately reduced down the tower of Sn to Sn1 times lambda times Snt. And this is called the split basis in mathematics literature, and this step is inefficient in general. And so this reference so from Harrell, the 05 paper, it actually constructs the Schwarz transform efficiently from the other side of the Schwarz duality, that is from the unit group side. And also there is a pre-existing claim in the literature that we can decompose from the symmetric group side efficiently, but unfortunately that claim is incorrect. And our second example will just be decomposing the edge alpha of a point-based K-Corbis teleportation, which is a representation for the K-system partially transposed permutation algebra. And as Cindy has shown us before, this is our edge alpha, which is an area of the partially transposed permutation algebra. And we're restricting to the subgroup Sn minus K of it. It will actually be a generalized induced representation. And the complexity of this can be easily characterized as well. So all of those key will have degenerate eigenvalues. So X2 will involve only the amplitude application for each of the ERS mu. And the quantum Fourier transform is simply reduced on the standard tower, so the first step X will be efficient as well. And when k equals to 1, this X2 can be incorporated efficiently into a whole circuit with core-based application, and that is the source of efficiency for our circuit for core-based application. And finally, I will just introduce you to a few more generalized induced representation diagram algebras. So in the first one, we have the standard show reliability. And as introduced before, the models limit our tree-induced graphs. In the second one, we are having the matrix algebra for the world graph algebra, where we are partially transposing the last K systems. And here is the last Q systems. And so by mapping it into the tensor space, this will be the matrix algebra of the Bloom graph algebra, which is a partially transposed algebra, and its conversion, as we introduced before, is the partially conjugated unitary group. And for the third and fourth row, these are the two types of Bloom algebra, whose conversions are respectively the algebra for the complex orthogonal group and the complex synclinal group. And as we will be showing in our upcoming papers, all of the irreps of those three types of Brouwer algebra, they are actually all generalized in these representations. And so this in principle gave us a way to decompose the tensor spaces into irreps for those four algebras way. And this preliminary is based on a decomposition of a space, a so-called harmonic tensor space, which consists of all tensors which are traceless. And this is the work in progress. So to sum up our results, which is in our October paper and the upcoming paper, first we have a poly and efficient algorithm for quantum port-based teleportation motivated by this problem. We have first create a procedure of block diagonalizing the homomorphic images of representations into irreducible representations, which we consider two cases. The first one is we do not care about orthogonality, then we can just use some classical algorithm which make use of linear algebra. If we care about the orthogonality, and if we are happen to have a gene variant in the product, then we can construct image using a grand procedure, also split up into two steps. The first one is that we will work in a pre-image and find a block diagonalization method. And in the second step, we will use the same basis transformation in the image, and then we will block diagonalize the already block diagonalized grand matrix to give us an orthogonal basis. And we, based on that, give a quantum algorithm for block diagonalizing and generalized induced representations, which is a novel object that we defined. We derive the first step and we do the second step to specific cases. And in our paper, we also give a pedagogical intro to diagram algebras and show that all of their irreps are generalized induced representations, which can be spotted out easily. And by using this fact in our general algorithm, we apply them to the general algorithm in diagram algebras, for example, the Schur transform and the twisted Schur transform to implement a port-based teleportation. And finally, some discussion. The first one is we know that the Schur transform and the generalized Schur transform can be worked from the two sides. And if we have some algorithm from the other side of the diagram algebra, then this may be bridged. If we can bridge those two to give an alternative algorithm for block diagonalized and generalized induced graphs. It turns out that this rule depends on some correct subregion spaces of the other side. And this is already appears in the standard show ideality, but for the current algorithm for generalized show ideality, the other side are in some others, in some spaces that are reduced down some other towers, so it is still not fixing this. Filling up this gap. And also, can we make use of the non-orthogonality and non-unitarity that appears, for example, in generalized caught by generous induced rep span between the different copies of the subrepresentation usually in the generalized induced rep. Can you make them useful in quantum computing? And also, for generalized induced rep, their in-reps are a subset of all of the in-reps in the tree induced reps. So if we know how which in-reps we are having, can they give more information of, for example, the localization of the base rep in the parent rep of the generalized induced rep? Or can we have something new? So
that's all. Thank you. Any questions? I maybe have one question. So I guess there's been some, I was struggling to remember, but some variants of port teleportation that have come out. So I think in particular there was one where you make the measurement and your system like consists of multiple qubits, let's say, and then the system appears on like some subset of qubits of the ports.
Yes,
maybe somebody.
This is the K-core based hub.
Okay, yeah, so I don't know, can you guys do that version or?
Yeah, we can give an algorithm for that. It should be some optimization such that getting the overhead minimum that we have to do.
Okay, but it's clear it's polynomial, I guess.
Maybe using our algorithm, we will have some doing some blocking coding and amplitude implications
of them that will
slow
the algorithm. Okay, so it's maybe not totally clear.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there, I think you guys discussed this in your paper, maybe, but there's like two variants of port teleportation. There's the like, I think the one you talked about where it's just with high fidelity appears on one of the ports, and then there's one where it appears exactly on one of the ports, but with some probability, it's just like a fail. And you guys do both cases, or?
Yeah, that is the probabilistic one. Yeah, I can get easily generalized from our algorithm.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, now let's thank our speakers again.